Mr. Hargreaves, Reel 1. Can you tell me something, first of all, about where you were born and something about your family background, please?
I was born in 19th of July, 1923. I was born in a place called Oswald Thistle, which at that particular time was quite a musical joke.
What did your father do for a living?
I had a stepfather. My own father had died in 1928, more or less from the effects of the First World War, in which he had the DCM and the father.
What jobs did your father and stepfather do?
My father, he was what they call an overlooker. That was in the textile industry in Richton. My stepfather, he was a chemical process worker. I think he fell on a bit of the hard times. He married my mother somewhere about 1932 and 1933. He was quite a good stepfather, a very, very good stepfather.
Was the family poor or comfortable or what?
Well, we weren't poor and we weren't comfortable. We were able to exist week by week. We were never short of food, and we always had something to wear. But our existence was purely local. I mean, you know, we never went beyond the... If we went 20 miles away, that was a marathon for us.
What was your education?
My education, mother always stressed on to me, as they did to everybody in those days, that only with education could you get on. And I passed my scholarship and I went to Accrington Grammar School. But I was there until the beginning of the war, or just before the war, and things got a little bit... hectic at home. I think their father was on short time or unemployed or something like that, and my mother had to come away. But at that time, they were taking them on at the Cooperative Society, and I applied for a job there. Now, it was the same in those days, you know. If you worked at the co-op, you were right for life. And I had to apply in my own handwriting. And I had to go for an interview. I was selected to go for an interview. Well, it was a proper old cooperative society offices with a big flight of stone stairs. And there must have been 50 blokes selected for this interview. I can remember standing there on the steps. Anyway, we went down. We had to go up front of the committee, as they call it. Eventually, I was selected to work for the cooperative society at Oswald Thistle.
What were you doing when war was declared?
When war was declared? I was working for the Cooperative Society.
What was your reaction to the war declaration?
What was the reaction? Well, not a lot. You were led to believe that it was the other fellow's fault, you know. This is how it goes. Because... You didn't know what was going on the other side of the outside Lancashire, should I say.
But did you feel apprehensive?
I don't know. I can't really say, you know. I can't say to that. I can't say.
Were you in Lancashire when the Blitz occurred?
Oh, yes, I remember. yes, I was. Actually, the first bombs that ever dropped on this country, some of them dropped on just outside Accrington, between Accrington and Clayton-le Moors. And I remember that Sunday, because they ran special coaches from Manchester and from old towns. And these coaches were full, you know, buses. And then just to see the houses had been damaged by a bomb. Little did those people from Manchester understand what was going to happen to them. There was just a one-off. I don't know. There was about 3 people killed, something like that. That was on Wally Road in Clayton Le Moors.
Which month would that have been, do you think?
It would be in 1941. 1940, 1941, something like that. It was before the actual bombing of the United Kingdom came about. It was actually the first bombs, I do believe.
Was there much damage caused?
Oh, yes, there were about 3 houses. And as a matter of fact, the other day, passing there in the with my wife in the car, and I just happened to speak about this particular incident, because there's a gap in the terraced houses, you know. And I said, that's where the bombs dropped. But there was a number of people. They had traffic and pedestrian control on that Sunday for the people going past.
Did you go?
Oh, of course. I had to go and have a look.
What else do you remember about the subsequent bombing?
I remember just after that, well, it'd be a few months probably later, that the bombing did come around, and there was bombing in Oswaldwater, where we live, but I think it was more or less that the bombers coming over had just discharged the bombs, you know, to get away or something like that, because they didn't hit any particular target. But I remember them coming down and the damage done, you know, and at that particular time with Oswaldwater, there were a lot of big works around there, a lot of big industries, such as Howard and Bullers, which was one of the big ammunition makers, and eventually turned into aircraft. And all Oswaldwater was provided not only with an emergency water supply, which were pipes running alongside the road at surface level, and where a street went off, the pipe went underneath the ground, for that little bit, but also they had what they call a smoke screen, and this was going down the main road. There'd be 2 cans with chimneys, something like a dustbin with a chimney on, and there'd be 2 of them, and they'd be staggered about every 50 yards, something like that. So on a moonlight night, I think it was a Pioneer Corps that was stationed in Acton, and they used to come round and light them. And it was some kind of old oil or something like that which they used. And consequently, you went to the cinema and came out at night, you had a hell of a job to find your way home. What with all the coughing and spluttering, your tied handkerchiefs round your mouth, and that. But the smoke screen was terrible. Really fantastic. Have you ever been told of this before?
Never.
And also, beside having the smoke screen, they had the balloon barrage in the surrounding the town.
Did the bombing create much fear?
I don't know. There was I can't explain it, but there was an atmosphere amongst people, not like it is today. If anybody got in trouble, everybody been out to help them. I don't think you could have the same things today, like with people being evacuated from Manchester, more or less to country places, like to Oswaldwater or something like that. The way the people took those children in, it was really fantastic. That spirit doesn't exist today, by any means.
Was that spirit just because we were at war?
No, that spirit existed before. But since the war, that spirit has been lost.
Why do you think it is?
Selfishness, I would say. Everybody for their own make.
So the bombing didn't create demoralization?
Oh no, far from it. Far from it. I think more my own view, and this is personally my own view, that it more or less it got your hackle up. You know, I think we're It raised the morale, I think.
But do you think that morale would have suffered if the bombing had been very much worse?
That I don't know. But at the rate of what it was, it made the people determined to that they would see it through.
Did people hate the Germans?
No, not really. Not really. When you talk about Germans, you know, not only were the Germans, but the Italians. They were, after 1940, they were on the enemy side. But I'll just tell you an instance about the Italians. In Oldenthal, there was a cinema called the Palace Cinema. And this was owned by an Italian. I've just forgot his name now, what it were. Proper Italian name, you know. And just outside of Twistle on the moors, there was a prisoner of war camp. Now, when they were Germans, they more or less kept them behind fencing, behind barbed wire. But in relation to the Italians, they kind of let them roll here, there, and everywhere. Nobody seemed to take any notice of them. The funniest thing about it was that with the Italians coming down into Oswald, they were allowed into the cinema free, the Italian prisoners of war, and the British Army had to pay. A ridiculous situation, but nobody bothered, and, you know. The atmosphere was fantastic. It's hard to describe, you know, the closeness of people, how close they were.
Was there any anxiety on your part to get into the war?
You mean to join the army?
Yes.
No, but I'll tell you what, there was a story going around, and this is how I come to join the army. You know, they always said that if you could drive, which was, you know, there weren't many people who could drive in those days, if you could drive, you was probably made a cook. And if you worked in catering or something like that, you was learnt to drive. You were taught to drive. So I weighed all this job up and I said, well, surely I have to go in the army. I'd already tried thought about joining the Royal Navy. Just before this time, there were an aunt of mine had died up in Bacup. And it was an aunt of my father. And she left a little bit of money. And I thought, I don't know what I can do. I'd always had a bit of an inkling for radio. And I thought, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll go to the radio school at Preston. And if I pass the exam there, it was a full-time course, and you had to pay, I'll be able to join the Merchant Navy as a radio officer. So, with a bit of money that she'd left, I went and I took a course at the Northern Counties Radio School at Preston and passed the Postmaster General, making me eligible to go into the Merchant Navy. But more or less, I'd only passed the exam about a week, and I got a letter from the War Office asking me if I'd like to join a special detachment of radio operators in the Army, seeing I was a qualified radio operator.
When was this, that you got this invitation?
That was in 1942. In 1942, somewhere about May of 1942, something like that.
How did you respond?
Well, it was from a Colonel O'Zan. I always remember the name because it was so unusual. And they asked, would I like to go and have an interview? I think it was either the Cumberland Hotel, Northumberland Avenue, or Northumberland Avenue, Cumberland Avenue. I don't know. It was one of the two. Anyway, I went down there. But the main thing about it is, I was going down to London. Actually, I don't think I've been any further than Manchester, you know. And to go down to London, I might as well have been going on the other side of the moon with Armstrong there. Anyway, I went down and They said all expenses would be paid. Oh, I thought, well, expenses, it wouldn't stretch me going into a hotel or anything like that, you know. I just went on the train, had the interview, and came back straight away. Right, they're spreading the government's money. Anyway, I did, and Ozan, he told me, he said, look, he said, we want special radio operators because we're forming a special detachment that needs good radio operators, and you being a special one, you know. I said, would I be guaranteed to be working radio and all that? And he said, oh, yes, you would. So from that, I volunteered to join. And within a few days, I got my papers, and I had to go somewhere over into Yorkshire for a couple of weeks or so, and I was kitted out. And then when they sent on my way, I was sent down to Henley-on-Thames, to a place called Fawley Court at Henley-on-Thames. There were one or two lads. I met Bill Pickering for the first time, another Lancashire lad, and one or two more. As a matter of fact, there were four coloured boys there from British Guyana. I think they used to work for Cable and Wireless, something like that. And apparently, at the end of the war, one turned out to be a big political leader in Guyana, Andrew Jackson. And I think another one stayed on in the army, Casey, but they were real black. And to be a black fella in those days was very, very unusual, you know. I think they were about the first black fellas I've ever seen. Well, they were great blokes. And also there were a lot of women who were in uniform, and these turned out to be fannies. But I soon found out what the fannies were, and they were of more or less of the daughters of the landed gentry. And they were learning radio, learning cipher. And then I saw a little bit of what was going to happen. I saw the taxes set to use, and little bits came to what the old unit was about. And I'll tell you what struck me then was a couple of blokes there. Well, it turned out it was like one of these American hero films. There was a couple of blokes there. One a squadron leader. He was called Squadron Leader Mallory. And another one, a major. And they called him Major K. But apparently, he was a Major Kakowski or something like that. Well, you talk about these guys packing six-shooters, slung low at the hips. These two had them. And they used to ride around shooting at trees, and I thought, what a queer outfit this is. Anyway, we got to know a little bit more of what was going on, and they eventually said that we were going to go abroad. I'd only been in the army a few weeks by then, and we said they were going to send us abroad. So they kitted us out with tropical gear, as we said. Now, this tropical kit must have been from the 1920s or 1930s, because I've never seen anything like it in all my life. The uniform, it was like a quilted back, and something which was, the old British Army was topies. They issued us with a topie. Whether it was all part of the kidology or what, I don't know, but they gave us this, put it in kit bags, and the topi sticking out of the top. Whether it was to mislead anyone, I don't know. Anyway, we set off, and we got on the train, and we didn't know which way the train was going or anything like that. There was no, as you looked out to the railway station, there was no, all the indicators had been taken down. There were no names on the railway stations. And we thought we're heading north and that, and I think the first thing we did recognize was that big bridge at, I think it was Newcastle, somewhere like that. And then we went on, and it carried on to the train, and then it pulled up at a little landing stage. And it's only in the recent years, well, this last 20 years of going up there, that I found out where it were. It's Wimsbay, just outside Lough. And there was the old British Navy, all the big cruisers and the troop carriers, all in the Clyde there. And we were taken out by boat out into the Clyde, and we were put on a trooper. I forgot the name of the ship. I think it was the Arundel Castle or something like that. It was some castle line anyway. We were put into, well, it wasn't a room. It was something, it was like covered in tarpaulin. And inside there were beds which were four high. Now, after the war, I going up to Glasgow quite a lot, and going down the Clyde on the ferry there, I noticed that they were breaking one of these castle lines, and lo and behold, it was that particular ship. I thought I'd go and have a look at it before they broke it proper. And I found out where I was sleeping, and what it was just a little inshot in the deck with a tarpaulin put at the front. It wasn't one of the rooms. Anyway, we were in these beds, and there were, as I said, there were four high. And they gave you training about if it was struck by torpedoes, emergency training with the boats and all like that. But the thing was, when the alarm went, everybody tried to pile out to the beds at once. It was a hell of a mess, you know. But anyway, we got on the steam, and we didn't know where we were going to. No idea at all.
Do you remember the names of any of the people who were with you?
Oh, yeah. Pickering was there. Calsall. And that. And also, on that ship, there were a lot of... Was it Queen Alexander's nursing sisters? Queen yes. Alexander's nursing sisters. Well, they had officer rank. We couldn't get any food or anything like any cigarettes or anything like that, any extras. But they were allowed, and they used to kind of smuggle it to us. But the funniest thing about it was that when you're at sea there, with having all these troops on. You know, the complement is fantastic. You're talking in thousands of people, and it's not possible to carry enough fresh water on there to supply everybody for washing facilities. So, and also the heads or the washing facilities were generally forward of the ship on the open deck. And to limit the amount of water used, the washing facilities used to be from, say, 7 o'clock till 7:15. But fresh water was on tap. After that, it was back to seawater. And I don't know whether you ever tried washing yourself in seawater yourself. It's bleaking awful, I'll tell you. Anyway, I was always one of those that got at the back of the queue when finished up, I went to washing seawater. But the worst thing was the feeding arrangements. The feeding arrangements, the messing was generally on the lowest deck possible in the ship. And if you queued up thousands of blocks, and the ship pitching and tossing, by the time it came to get the food, you didn't feel like it, you know, you felt sick. I think I went about 13 days or something like that. Being a bad sailor, I went about 13 days without anything to eat. It was that awful. Terrible, the conditions on the troopers. But needless to say, we plodded on. There were a couple of alarms. There was a ship sunk at the back of us by torpedo just as we went through the through Gib there into the Mediterranean. we pulled into a harbor there, and some old-timer said, "That's Algiers." He says, "I know by the shape of the harbor. It's shaped like a heart. That's Algiers." And lo and behold, it was Algiers. So we came off and we went up to a place past the race course, past Maison Carey, that was to the left of Algiers, looking at Algiers from the sea, to a place called Cap Mafefou. And here we started our first signal station. We picked a house that was built on four stilts. By the sea, a lovely place it was. We'd been there two or three weeks, and we moved to the other side of Algiers, about 20 miles the other side of Algiers, to a place called Club de Pan. Club de Pan, which turned out to be, as they call it, the code name of Massingham. And at Massingham, we had the French people, we had the Fannies. It was like a select village that had been built for the wealthy people of Algiers, and it was pretty isolated. You could actually barbed wire it all in. And as I said, we had the Fannies and the French. And we had some Americans with us, and these Americans were all ex-paratroopers. I can remember them as plain as anything. They had the T-shirts on, T-shirts with, I never knew what a T-shirt were to them. You used a vest, but they called it a T-shirt. I always remember what was written on it. It used to have Fort Benning, Fort Benning. And apparently that was the big parachute training place in the United States. Fort Benning, Georgia, that was it. Fort Benning, Georgia. And from Massingham, we...
Excuse me, you were telling me that Douglas Dodds Parker was in charge of Massingham.
Yes, yes.
And that you had a clash with him there.
Oh, yeah, that was later on. I'll come on to that. We put up the antenna, we put up a big signal station, and we helped in general around the fantastically. One thing that sticks out in my mind was right up front of the main offices was we had an ankle 111, and what was the other plane?
A German plane.
No, the Ankle 111 was a German plane, and the other was, I think it was a Junkers 52. It was either a Junkers 52 or an Italian Savoia Machete. They were on there for training purposes. Training was carried out all along the sand dunes and all like that. Parachute drops onto the sand dune. At that time, we hadn't done any parachute drops. But we had taken French people in for training, for sabotage, for explosive training and all like that, by the explosive experts. We were the radio fellows, and we kind of taught them the rudimentaries of radio. But what we were doing, we were sending them out into the field, which they could hardly work the radios. And it was, that time, the Germans were pretty nifty in France with their radio.